Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back to a special edition of As It Is. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today we will talk about a killer. It is a deadly virus known as Ebola. Most people who get infected die a painful death. There is no cure. There is no vaccine to prevent its spread. Aid workers are getting Ebola. Doctors are dying from it. Last Friday, Nigeria became the fourth West African country to confirm the presence of Ebola. 2 days later, Liberia announced it was closing most of its borders in an attempt to contain the virus. Medical workers on the ground in Africa are asking for more international help to contain this deadly disease. Anna Mateo has more on the Ebola outbreak.
An aid group reported this week that Ebola has infected a second American medical worker in Liberia. The American-based group, Samaritan's Purse, has medical experts working in the country. Samaritan's Purse announced Sunday that Nancy Wrightbull is in stable but serious condition at a hospital in Monrovia, the Liberian capital. She was helping with Ebola patients at the Case Management Center when she became infected. The aid group reported last Saturday that the virus also infected American doctor Kent Brantley. He is the medical director at the Case Management Center. He was taken to an isolation center for treatment. Such centers are used to keep the public away from patients suffering from infectious diseases. Melissa Strickland works for Samaritan's Purse. She says the doctor is receiving treatment but is not out of the woods, meaning he is not out of danger.
And we are hopeful for his recovery, but Ebola is an incredibly dangerous, deadly disease. So it is very premature to say that he's out of the woods.
The news of the two Americans testing positive for Ebola follows the death of Samuel Brisbane. Dr. Brisbane worked at Liberia's largest hospital. He was treating Ebola victims when he contracted the virus. He died recently at a treatment center near Monrovia. Melissa Strickland says there are a number of reasons why the virus is difficult to contain. She says that many areas affected by Ebola lack developed infrastructure, meaning good roads and other public services. Ms. Strickland says that superstition, stigma, and misinformation are adding difficulties to an already dangerous situation. A superstition is a belief based on fear of the unknown, and stigma is a poor opinion of someone based on their beliefs, or in this case, their having a disease.
You're dealing with countries who are in the developing world. They do not have the kind of infrastructure that we would see here in the United States. And the population, there's a lot of superstition, a lot of stigma associated with the disease, a lot of misinformation associated with the disease.
Melissa Strickland says Samaritan's Purse is treating people infected with Ebola. But at the same time, the group and other organizations are seeking to educate communities about the disease. And Ms. Strickland is appealing for help in what she calls A Battle Against Ebola.
What we need is a significant international effort to battle this disease, and we welcome other NGOs and other agencies who will come alongside us in this fight.
I'm Ana Mateo.
Last weekend, the president of Liberia announced measures to try to contain the Ebola virus. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf said that her country is closing most of its borders. The few entry points that will remain open are Monrovia's International Airport, a provincial airport, and three major overland border crossings. She said all these entry points will have prevention and testing centers. She added that the Liberia Airport Authority will inspect all incoming and outgoing passengers. The government has also banned public gatherings and demonstrations. In another development, health officials are attempting to identify who came into contact last week with a man who later died of the Ebola virus. Patrick Sawyer was 40 years old and served as an advisor to Liberia's finance ministry. Mr. Sawyer took a flight from Liberia to Ghana. He later changed airplanes in Togo for a flight to Nigeria, where he died last Friday. Witnesses said he was sick on at least one of his flights. He reportedly was vomiting and had diarrhea. The expulsion of food from the stomach and body wastes are signs of the disease. Patrick Sawyer was going to Nigeria for a conference. He planned to go to the United States to visit with his wife and children. On Monday, Nigerian officials announced that they had identified more than 50 people who came into contact with Mr. Sawyer. But some fear many more may have had contact with him than is currently known. Jide Idris is health commissioner in Lagos State. He says both the health and aviation departments are searching for other possible Ebola cases.
We call on all Nigerians to be calm and not panic, and do hereby assure them that both the state and the federal governments are up in arms to ensure that the virus does not escape and that no Nigerian is infected with this virus.
Ebola has killed about 700 people across West Africa this year. More than 1,200 others have been infected. Health workers say an outbreak in Lagos, Nigeria's largest city, would be an almost unimaginable disaster. Experts from the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are in West Africa. They are working with government ministries and international organizations to follow the spread of Ebola cases. In the past, the Ebola virus, currently active in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, killed 90% of those who got sick. The CDC says the death rate for the current outbreak is about 60%. Experts say this shows that early treatment is having an effect. Stephen Monroe studies emerging diseases for the Centers for Disease Control. He spoke during a conference from the CDC's headquarters in Atlanta, Georgia.
We know how to stop the outbreak, and that is to break the chains of transmission. And so what does that involve? It involves first identifying cases through active case finding, and then identifying all of their contacts who had contact with them during the time they were symptomatic and therefore are at risk of becoming infected themselves, and following those contacts daily for 21 days, and if they do develop symptoms, to get them into one of these isolation facilities.
Stephen Monroe says fear and misinformation are preventing some people from seeking treatment. He says what the CDC and health organizations are hoping to do is to find trusted members of the affected communities to publicize how to contain the disease. This has been a special edition of As It Is. We have spent the entire program discussing a deadly disease that has spread fear and death wherever it goes. We hope you have learned something, Perhaps you now know something that may even save your life or that of your friends and families. Thank you for spending some time with us today. We are here every day to tell you about our world and to help you learn and improve your American English. I'm Jim Tedder, and this is VOA, Washington.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Tens of thousands of Africans are studying in China. The country provides students with financial assistance for education to develop skills that Africa needs most. And the system makes friends in Africa for the Chinese. Violet Biwalya of Zambia is among the increasing number of Africans who are receiving financial help to study in China. She registered at Tanji University in Shanghai in September 2013. The school is among the top universities in the country. At a restaurant near Tanji, she shared some thoughts about being a Zambian student in China. For example, the university's restaurant serves Chinese food. Ms. Biwalya said before she arrived, she did not know she would see so many people like herself. She said the number of Africans in China greatly surprised her. The young woman said she is also excited by the level of development in China. She noted the tall buildings and many roads. She said, Zambia does not have many tall buildings. Violet Biwalya will study Mandarin during this year in China. Then she will go to another school to study medicine. Those classes will be taught in Mandarin. Some Africans say language barriers affect the quality of Chinese education. One man from Uganda criticized his studies in Wuhan, central China. The man asked that he not be identified. He said his classes are in English, but he said his professors cannot answer his questions because they do not speak English. The student said he himself does not know much Chinese.
Generally, I think the biggest challenge for an international student who comes to China to study English, an English course, is availability of lecturers who can actually speak English.
Another Ugandan student said it may be too easy to receive a degree in China.
Where I come from, you're really pushed by getting good grades. Yeah. You're not going to get a 90 by just showing up or just going to the exam. But here, when you come, they just give you 90s.
But most African students express satisfaction with their Chinese education. Juma Salum is from Zanzibar. He studies political science at Shanghai's International Studies University. Mr. Salum wants to return to help his country after graduation. He said he believes it is his duty to do so, and he said he wants to be a link between the Chinese and the people of Tanzania and all Africa. In 2012, China's Department of Foreign Assistance at the Ministry of Commerce said it had more than 27,000 students from Africa. By the end of 2013, more than 35,000 Africans were studying in China. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. I'm Jerry Watson.
welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. As we reported in our last program, slavery supporters failed to push through Congress a bill to make Kansas a slave state. Congress instead let the people of Kansas vote on the statehood constitution, written by pro-slavery men. The people rejected the Constitution, and slavery supporters gave up the fight for Kansas. Here are Steve Ember and Bob Doty to continue the story.
The problem of slavery continued to divide the North and South. Northerners warned that slavery could spread no farther. Southerners threatened to leave the Union unless Southern rights were protected. In the far West, one could forget this bitter dispute. There were no slaves in the West. The land and the weather were not right for the kind of farming that used slaves.
The West was growing quickly. Gold had brought thousands of settlers to California 10 years earlier. New discoveries of gold and silver now were leading men to Colorado, Arizona, and Nevada. "Don't go," warned the New York Tribune, "if you have a job or a farm. But if you have neither," it said, "and can get $50, then go to Colorado." There were many men without jobs or farms in the summer of 1858. The country had suffered a serious economic depression the year before, and jobs were difficult to find. Thousands left cities in the East. The first ones to reach Colorado reported that gold was easy to find. They said any man who worked hard could find $5 to $10 worth of gold a day, and sometimes even more.
The thousands who rushed to Colorado soon found that there was not as much gold as expected. The valuable metal became harder to find. No longer could it be washed from the bottoms of mountain streams. Men had to dig into the mountains of rock to get it. Huge digging machines and crushers were needed to get the gold from the rock. These machines were expensive. Few men had enough money to buy them. Some of the miners organized companies. They borrowed money from Eastern banks or sold shares of their companies. In a few years, almost all of the gold from Colorado came from the mining companies.
Many of those who went west to search for gold stayed to become farmers or storekeepers. Others moved farther west to find gold in Nevada or California. Some cleared the ground of trees and cut them into wood for houses. Such timber from the forests of Oregon and Washington was sold in California and Mexico, even in China and Hawaii. A few men recognized the need for transportation across the nation. Engineers planned 4 railroads, but Northern and Southern leaders could not agree on which one to build first. Until a railroad could be built, supplies were carried west in wagons, pulled by horses or oxen. 3 men, Russell, Majors, and Waddell, formed a transportation company in 1855 to carry government supplies to soldiers in the West. They started with 500 wagons. 3 years later, the company had 3,500 wagons and 40,000 oxen.
Getting letters to and from the West was not easy in the 1850s. Ships brought mail to San Francisco 2 times a month. And once each month, mail would arrive in California after a slow trip by wagon from St. Louis, Missouri. The federal government decided to send mail overland 2 times a week to California. It gave the job of carrying the letters to a new company, the Overland Mail Company. The mail was carried by train or boat to St. Louis. Then it was put on Overland Company stage coaches, light wagons pulled by 4 or 6 horses. The company was told to take the mail along a 4,000-kilometer southern route through Arkansas, Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona. The mail arrived in Los Angeles 24 days after it left St. Louis.
There was a shorter way across the country, but the postal chief was a Southerner, A.V. Brown. He believed stagecoach travel might lead the way for a railroad, and he wanted a Southern railroad to California. Brown said the Southern route was the only one that could be kept open in all seasons. He said the other routes would be closed by snow in winter. The overland stagecoaches were large enough to carry 4 passengers, but not many people went to California in the coaches. The coaches never stopped for very long, only to change horses or drivers, and there were not many places to eat. Also, the trip was dangerous because of hostile Indians.
The shortest distance between Missouri and California was across the central part of the country. The Russell, Majors, and Waddell Company decided to show that this central route could be used all year. It began a speedy mail service called the Pony Express. Letters were carried by riders on fast horses. Stations with fresh horses were built about 24 kilometers apart all along the way. A rider would change horses at each station until he had traveled 120 kilometers. Then he would give his letters to another rider. In this way, the letters would be carried between California and Missouri. The first letters sent by Pony Express from California took 10 days to reach Missouri. The Pony Express lasted only 18 months. It was no longer needed after a telegraph line was completed to San Francisco.
As communications and transportation improved, the government was able to increase its control over the West. But closer ties were not welcomed between the government and a religious group known as the Mormons. The Mormon religion was started by a young New England man named Joseph Smith. In 1823, at the age of 18, Smith claimed that an angel told him of a golden book. He said, "The book contained God's words to the ancient people of America." Smith said he was able to read the strange writing in this book and put it into English. He called this work the Book of Mormon.
He organized a church and made himself its leader. Many people became Mormons. They believed themselves to be a special people chosen by God. Mormons worked hard. They helped each other and shared with those in need. People who did not agree with the beliefs of the Mormons did not like them. Trouble developed between Mormons and other people. Joseph Smith was forced to move his people from New York to Ohio and then to Missouri. The Mormons seemed finally to have found a home in Illinois. They built their own town and called it Nauvoo. They governed themselves and had their own defense force. The Mormons did so well that Nauvoo became the fastest-growing city in Illinois.
Oh, what a dreary place this was when first the Mormons found it. They said no white men here could live, and Indians prowled around it. They said the land, it was no good, and the water was no gooder, and the bare idea of living here was enough to make men shudder.
Then some members of the group split apart because of a new message Smith claimed to have received from God. Smith said God gave permission for Mormons to have more than one wife. This was polygamy, and it was opposed by almost all people. Some of the Mormons who left the church published a newspaper criticizing Smith and the other Mormon leaders. Followers ordered by Smith destroyed the newspaper's publishing equipment. This caused non-Mormons to demonstrate and demand that Smith be punished. Smith was arrested and put in jail in Carthage, Illinois. His brother also was arrested. An angry mob attacked the jail and shot both Smith and his brother to death. The governor of Illinois ordered the Mormons to leave his state. He said only this would prevent further violence. There was no choice. They had to leave. The Mormons had a new leader, Brigham Young. Young decided to take his people west and find a new home for them. He wanted a place where they would be safe, where no one could interfere with their religion. Brigham Young told his people that he had seen their new home in a dream. He said they would search for it in the west, for a wide, beautiful valley. He said he would recognize it when he saw it. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. Your narrators were Steve Ember and Bob Doty. Our programs are online with transcripts, podcasts, and MP3s at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.